Alan. I'm going to call it.
All right, so online we have Leah with 26 days. We have Megan with a year and 9 months. And we got Velma with 48 days today. I'm Sam. I have 8 months and 1 day. Thank you for letting me be here.
Thank you, Sam. Now it's the treasurer. Mr. David? That's you, right? Or that's Bill. Okay. Come on up, Bill.
Okay. Who's got the money?
Hey, guys. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bill Hatzman. Still. And I'm your acting treasurer. We got elections going on up in here next Wednesday. And so we invite all of you to come and be a part of that process, whether you want to be in an office that we are going to elect, or whether you want to just be part of the electing body that puts people to work here. That's always fun, right? Putting other people to work. Corey, listen to me. I'm sorry. I couldn't resist. All right, so anyway, we're going to have elections right here in this room, 5:30 next Wednesday. And if you'd like to count the money, I invite you to please come and take this job from me. In the meantime, as of last week, we had a collection of $49.80 here in person and $35 through the Venmo app for a total collection of $84.80. And that brought to our balance $490.66. So another thing that we're going to do that's a lot of fun next week is we're going to talk about how to spend that money. So if you like to spend money, it'd be another good reason to come visit us at 5:30 right here in this room next Wednesday. And I completely blew the script, didn't I? I did it again. Congratulations to all who are celebrating, and we especially want to welcome home all of our new friends. We have been, while I've been chit-chatting, observing the seventh tradition, which states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. Newcomers and non-AA members need not to contribute. You can contribute and put any papers to be signed in the basket. We also have digital contribution capability through Venmo. We have the Visalia VG account. If you're online, you'll be seeing that on your screen. And the Valley Group does regularly donate all surplus funds. And with that, it's my pleasure to give the screen back here to Israel.
Thanks, Bill.
Israel Alcoholic, our speaker tonight comes to us from Exeter, and his home group is Friday Morning Attitude Adjustments. And as you heard, he just turned 41 years old, which is awesome. We can do him another round. He has the unique distinction of being the very first person I ever heard share an AA a little over 5 years ago when I first came in. So everybody give it up for Alan.
Hello, everybody. My name's Alan. I'm an alcoholic. I clock out here. When we were driving up here, we pulled into this parking lot. It was just crowded with cars. And I got to feeling really kind of egotistical and flattered and honored. And we got out of the car. We started looking for the church. Can't find it anywhere. And turns out that parking lot was with a baseball game. So that I got back in the car, we got down here. Still a lot of people who are now in my life, a lot of people that are happy to see me, that kind of thing. That's a big gift for me, my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, is being a part of this thing and having been able to stay a part of it all these years. And that giving me a life that's really a pleasant experience nowadays. You know, it's nice to be this old and sober. and it wasn't always that way. So anyway, I started out in a family. I had they were nice people. They're church-going people. We belonged to this religion called Lutheran, and they weren't real. They didn't do a lot of preaching or anything. We said grace before meals, and we went to church every Sunday, and they kind of left it to the Sunday school teachers and the preachers to bring me up right. They just expected me to do the right thing, and there wasn't a lot of negotiating with those parents, you know. I knew what was expected, and they expected me to know what was expected, and that's sort of how it was. And it was a loving home. My dad worked hard to provide for us. My mother was a stay-at-home mother, and I had seven brothers and sisters. So, you know, it was a pretty peaceful upbringing, and I'm very grateful for that. They didn't drink, so I didn't learn much about drinking till I was, you know, about high school age. Something happened when I was 4 or 5 years old. I just woke up one day and I was all pissed off about the way things were. And I don't know if it was sibling rivalry stuff or what it was, but things weren't going my way, and I thought I deserved more than I had. And I started looking for ways to be, you know, to stand out from the crowd, I guess, you know, to be important, to be significant. I had these two older brothers, and they were doing fine with all that shit, but I had to kind of start finding my way in all of it and started competing for attention and all that, I guess. And I started relying on my own ways of doing things and methods of getting that attention, I guess. You know, I was writing this little article for the newsletter a while back on the fourth step, and I thought about the fourth step, and for some reason it took me back to being like 3 or 4 or 5 years old, something like that, in a doctor's office, getting ready to get some inoculation shot, and I was scared to death of getting the shot like any kid would be. And my mother, in an attempt to keep me quiet or just help me out with the situation, whatever it was, she took me into her arms and just gave me this big, loving embrace. And it was so euphoric and so peaceful, and I just melted into her arms. And next thing I know, I'd already had the shot, and I hadn't even noticed it happening. And I thought, I look back at that day and I thought, man, my mother taught me something that maybe she didn't intend for me to learn, but I sure picked up on it quickly. And that was that if I could find a way to not deal with the things that scared me, if I can look away and not notice that they're happening, I could avoid a lot of pain in my life. And then I started taking that lesson. You know, even today I go in and get some blood drawn, I look away. But anyway, that lesson, I don't know that set up some way of thinking or anything, but or maybe it's just because I was already thinking that way that seemed like a real big event in my little life. But after that, I started finding ways to kind of like skew my view of reality, to avoid things that were scary and painful as a kid and all that stuff. And I started taking on these personality things, these coping mechanisms, I guess you'd call them, that helped me avoid the scary things in life, like, you know, criticism and rejection and guilt and all these things. I started developing skills like rationalization, justification and rebellion and all these things so I wouldn't have to deal with these things that came along in my life. And that went on and it kept going on as I grew up. And by the time I was a teenager, I was just a lonely, pathetic, weird ass mess with not very many friends and longing to be a part of things and not knowing how to go out there because I had all this bad information that I'd given myself as I grew up to deal with it all. And one thing that took place there is all those coping mechanisms I came up with on my own, they required a lot of dishonesty. They required a lot of memory, a lot of creativity to back up the lies you kept telling everybody else and yourself. When I finally discovered alcohol, man, I was ready for it. And I didn't have to have any brain power to make that work. And I didn't have to have any memory to make that work. All I had to do is take a drink. And for a little while, I felt all right. And I felt relaxed. And I felt at home. And, you know, I love that feeling. From the moment I tried alcohol, all those anxieties and fears and weirdness that I kind of developed as I grew up would just disappear for a while. And I would feel okay. And, you know, at that point in my life, if I would have said, oh, this isn't good for me, I would have had to have been crazy. Because it looked like I'd been living with an alcohol deficiency all my life. Because I was not equipped to deal with life the way life was. I had a bunch of fear, and my biggest fear was admitting I was afraid. I had dishonesty with myself that I couldn't even, you know, that I couldn't even see through. You know, I didn't know I was lying to myself. And I saw things so crazy. I was reading the 12 and 12 this morning again, and I went to that part in the 12th step, and they talk about this study they did way back in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a couple of, or a handful of psychologists wanted to find out what were the three, or they wanted to find out what were the traits that alcoholics shared. And the ones that came down to the main three that most alcoholics exhibited were emotional sensitivity, childishness, and grandiosity. And I can look back over my life, and that's my resume, you know. That's what I brought to every situation, and all I could do with that was end up being defensive and afraid and dishonest and manipulative, because I didn't even trust myself to be worthy of having a nice life that was just felt good, you know. You know, they say, in the doctor's opinion, they talk about this alcoholism as being an obsession of the mind. You know, there's something in my mind that tells me no matter what's going on in my life, if I take a drink, that thing is going to get better. It's going to feel better. And I definitely had that. And then they told me the other side of this story, which is the compulsion. Which means I have this allergy thing. That means my liver, when it processes alcohol, it puts out some enzyme that makes me crave the thing. And the craving gets so strong that it's more important than everything else in my life. And I could see that I had that too. So I got all the education I needed when I came to AA. When they taught me that about myself, it was time to know what I had to do next. I had a lot of excuses for my failure at life. I had a lot of reasons for why you didn't know how important I was. But I had never been told the truth about my situation, my physical and mental setup for this alcoholism. And there was someone that paraphrased the doctor's opinion for me one morning in a noon meeting there at the Alcohol Milano Club. And the guy said, you know, you got two things to work with in this world on your own. You got a mind and a body. And he said, and if you're an alcoholic, you got a mind and a body, and they're both working against you. So the verdict is you're fucked. On your own, you haven't got a chance. And he said, and that's why we need this higher power. We need something that's stronger than what we are and something that can guide us out of that sickness we're in. And that was, you know, when I heard that, it was my second trip to AA, not my second meeting, but my second attempt at AA. And the second attempt was after my third drunk driving offense. I was in my 30s. I had had all the fun that alcohol could bring. You know, I'd left a titty bar airborne once. I stood in front of a urinal and pissed my own pants once. I had this girlfriend when I was about, I don't know, somewhere between 18 and 21. We were hanging out, and we got in some big fight one night, and we were both drunker than hell. And we lived in this little small town where, you know, they have kind of houses built next door to each other, but there's not sidewalks and stuff. You know, it's just kind of the pavement just goes into the yards, kind of like from the road. And we were sitting there out on the road fighting, and we both fell asleep and passed out while we were fighting. And when I woke up, I was still mad at her, and I said, ah, screw her. And I left, and I drove home, left her laying there in the road. And it's not really funny. I mean, it's funny now. But, you know, I look back, and, you know, that's just some of the crap I did as a drunk. And I'm sure all of you had your funny and goofy and tragic experiences. You know, I got in one wreck that split my head open, and I had to get hauled down to the hospital and stitched up. And that was my first drunk driving offense. And I didn't go to jail that night. I just got stitched up and taken home, and I got charged in the mail, you know, about a month later. There were some other, you know, there was a lot of other stuff. I guess, you know, there's stuff like having unprotected sex with people you don't even know. And it sure didn't happen much. I'm not saying you, Don Juan, or anything. A couple of times I got lucky and got to go home with someone and sneak out in the morning kind of thing. And, you know, just stuff like that. It was like not a life you're like proud of and want to tell your grandkids about or anything. And it's like that was the best I could do. And my job, I had this janitor job that I got because I knew somebody. And I stayed there. Well, I got to AA after I'd been there about 3 years or 7 years. So I stayed there 7 years. Well, basically, I stayed there 10 years because I was just too chicken shit to leave and go find another job. I got this paycheck every month, paid the bills. It was for some school district, so I got some benefits thrown in with it, you know, and I got my bills paid once a month, so I always, you know, I always paid rent. So I wasn't out on the street, but just drank up all the rest of it. So anyway, and then I was really I kind of saw myself as this real bright, shining star. You know, I was writing songs since I was in high school, and I thought that was going to be my big ticket out, that one day I'd have some big hit record, and I'd stand on stages, and millions of people would love me, but no one would even have to know me, and you know, stuff like that. And you know, I kept on with that fantasy. Oh, I'm still doing it, actually. But no, I was like writing songs. But it's just like it's a tough way to make a living, especially when you don't have a hell of a lot of talent. But anyway, this janitor job was a big disappointment. But it, you know, the silver lining in that was I got to see myself as this misunderstood genius, you know, and I got to take that self-pity trip one more time down the river. And I'd sit there in my big bay window. I had this apartment. I don't know. It must have been designed for the night watchman or something, but it was the only apartment that didn't look over the swimming pool. It looked out over the parking lot. And that's what I did. I'd sit up there looking out over the parking lot, watching people come and go, smoking joints, drinking beers, and dreaming about what a big shot I was going to be when people woke up and found out how important I was. And that just went on and on and on until I started getting into trouble with my driving. I wasn't getting in a lot of, violence or exciting home wrecker stuff or anything like that wasn't going on in my life. I was pretty much a loner, and my only friend was alcohol by the time I was in my mid-20s. You know, I had these parents that loved me and all that stuff. And of course, way back in high school, when my smoking cigarettes and cussing and all that stuff started, I started living a double life with them and started becoming a phony around my own house. And, you know, that just got bigger and bigger, and the gap got wider and wider as I continued this lifestyle of a stoner. So when I started getting in trouble with my driving, I got introduced to AA, and I remember coming into AA, and the thing I noticed right off the bat was there's this room full of people from like all walks of life, all different, you know, races, creeds, colors, ages, professions, all that kind of stuff, just different as night and day, some of them. And there was kind of a core group of AA people that were serious in there, kind of making sure the meeting started and everything like that. But most of the rest of us were there because we were like either new or court slip guys and stuff. And that's why I was there. I was there to get my little court slip signed. But I remember being really, really impressed with the honesty in that room. The honesty of people getting up on these podiums and talking about who they were and where they've really been and what they're really doing now and what was going on in their lives, all this shit that was going on in their family life that I would have been damn embarrassed to talk about in front of a bunch of people, you know. So I was impressed with that. And then I was also blown away by that, in spite of all this kind of tragedy shit going on in the conversation, there was this irreverent sense of humor, this laughter that was just, it was wonderful, is the word for it, I guess. It was people who were laughing from the same place I would laugh from. And they made me laugh about my own silliness, you know, and about the places I've been and why I did things and all these things that I had no clue about until I got to AA and some people started sharing their lives honestly with me. And I got to start learning through your example who I was. And that was a real beautiful thing to me. But my first time around, I just didn't realize the power of this alcoholism thing. I thought, you know, I had some trouble with my driving. If I just leave the booze alone and just smoke pot, I'll be all right. And I went out and went on for a couple more years that way. I don't know. I must have drank once in a while. But basically, I just was exclusively a pothead. And, of course, potheads, they kind of get into this sort of weird psychosis, you know, this paranoia thing and all that. So I got weirder and weirder in my head as time went on, too. I got to the point where just going through the grocery store line was like a big traumatic experience. And I'd be vibrating like hell by the time I got out of there, run home, smoke a joint, and dream about what a big star I was going to be. And, you know, it just went on and on like that. Finally, I rediscovered alcohol. I'd been sitting around. I had an apartment. It was one of those apartments with a big long hallway and doors in it like a hotel, you know. And I didn't know anybody behind any of those doors, you know. I sat in there in that cloud of marijuana smoke in my apartment looking out over the parking lot when I was at home. That's what I did. I didn't even go down and use that swimming pool. And so I didn't know anybody there. And one day I did decide I was going to go down and use the pool. And I went down to the swimming pool. And there were some guys down there. And they offered me a beer. And I start drinking beer. And all of a sudden this weird paranoid pothead guy just turns into a regular guy. And I'm talking about football, motorcycles, and all this stuff. And next thing I know, I'm heading up to that store up on the corner and buying a couple six-packs and coming back. And then I don't know what happened. It was a weird thing because, like I said, all these people, I didn't know them. But they all decided they're going to have some kind of party or something. And I always like to think that they were celebrating me coming out of the apartment. But I don't think that was it. But anyway, they were all getting together. They're going to have this kind of potluck thing, you know. So I went up to get my contribution. I went back to the grocery store. And by that time, I'm pretty hammered already on just beer and pot. And I everybody else getting chips and all that stuff. And I got a pint or a half pint of some kind of whiskey. And I come back. And I remember sitting down at the table. And these people, I guess, were just a lot more normal than I was. I said, hey, you want a hit, you know. And they pass that bottle around the room, around this picnic table. And it gets back to me. And nothing's gone, you know. So it was up to me to finish it off. And I was, like I said, I was a pothead and a beer drinker. So you add tequila or whiskey to the mix. And then I just turned into an instant belligerent asshole and, you know, left bars airborne and stuff like that. I thought it was clever, but I was belligerent is the word. And I did that every now and then. But anyway, I was down there and I got really, really drunk that night and made an ass out of myself and stumbled around this apartment complex, you know, using bad language in front of little kids and, you know, all the stuff that drunks do. And I went to bed that night, but I didn't really remember what had happened. And I got told the next day how much fun I had and everything. But that pretty much started off my last year of drinking. And my last year of drinking was, you know, I had this little bit of AA experience. I had a little bit of knowledge that I wasn't a person that should be drinking, that there was something different about me. And so I had my own version of One Day at a Time, and it was, you know, well, maybe I'll get sober tomorrow, but today, fuck it, I'm going to get drunk, you know. And I just went on and on and on until one night, leaving the bar, I got in my car and drove off and forgot to turn my lights on, and the cops saw me and pulled me over, took me to jail, and that was my third drunk driving. At that time, it looked like the penalties, you know, were going to maybe be that I was going to have to at least live in jail for about 2 weeks at minimum. And I'd never done that. I'd spent the night a couple of times, and that was it. So I was real worried about that, what was going to happen in court. And then I started going to meetings the same reason I went before. So I get my court slip thing signed and show the judge how I'm turning my life around and shit. And I started going to these meetings again. But this time there was just something a little different about it. But I wasn't getting sober yet. I was still drinking a little on the side, still smoking dope. But I was going to these meetings before I went off to work those days. And I'm waiting for that month to go by and go to court. And I'm thinking a lot, you know, doing a lot of thinking about my life and what was going on in my life and how worried I was about, you know, going and actually living in jail for a while and stuff. And I went up to this bar on the, it was a Saturday night for the Monday when I had the court date. And I went up to this bar and I walked up to this bar close to my house and I just sat there and I drank these whiskey drinks. I don't know if it was whiskey on the rocks or whiskey and water or what it was, but it was the kind of thing that usually turned me into a mouthy asshole, you know. And what it did was I just got quiet and more into my depressed feelings and stuff. And I left that bar and went home and went to bed. And when I woke up in the morning, I woke up with this hangover that I, you know, I just ached all over and all that stuff. And I tried to drink a little beer to mellow out. And I couldn't even swallow the stuff. And I just, that morning, it all just hit me who I was and what was really going on in my life. You know, I'd heard these people in the AA meetings describe what alcoholism was for me and all that. And it was pretty clear that if I was ever going to have a life that was happy or contented or productive or any of those, you know, positive words, I was going to have to find a way to leave that stuff behind. And going to jail, not going to jail, that wasn't my problem. My problem was I needed to be able to live life without some kind of chemical help. And I started thinking about this higher power, and I'd been taking to church all through my childhood and everything, and I had kind of taken on sort of a childish view of God, and it was all about punishment and reward and religion being some kind of afterlife for the, you know, insurance policy for the afterlife. And it all looked different to me that morning. I realized that the afterlife was the least of my problems. That right here, right now in this life, I couldn't make the simplest stuff work. I couldn't do all those things I wanted to do. You know, all that stuff like have a career and marry a nice lady and have a family and drive cars that weren't hand-me-downs from my brothers and sisters, you know, and just all that stuff, you know, just have a little pride in who I was and be a little productive in my life. And I couldn't make any of that work on my own. I could see that my problem was right here, right now, in this life. I needed God's help. And I got down the first time in my life and got real with this higher power. And, you know, I kind of like to think that I did my third step that morning, even though I didn't do it officially with a sponsor till later, but I got down on my knees and I asked God to give me what it would take to stay sober. And you know, the next day I went to court and the court thing went really, really easy. You know, they gave me this alternative sentencing thing where part of it was to be in an AA meeting once a week. Another part was to be in this kind of a, you know, education thing about drugs and alcohol and that kind of thing. And meet a counselor every 2 weeks. And I walked out of that courtroom and I just thought, wow, it's really changing. Everything's going to be all right. I just felt like that. I just felt like it was really, everything had changed. And I think I went home, I still had some pot there and I still had the beers left over from, you know, what was sitting around the house. And I threw all that stuff out and I started going to these AA meetings, but instead of one a week, I started going every night, mostly because there was nothing else going on in my life. But there was another thing going on, and there was a lot of excitement in those meetings. For me, I was listening to these people. Everyone that got up on the podium and shared in that Alano Club were like big experts on alcoholism to me. And some of them had 30 days, some of them had 30 years, but they all had the experience of an alcoholic who was staying sober, and I wanted to learn about that, and I wanted to do what they were doing. And I started doing what they're doing. I got a big book, and I started reading that, and I got some friends. I started hanging out with them and talking about God all night and all that stuff that we do when we're new. And it just got exciting and fun, you know. That drug education class was one of the most instructive things I went through. It really was, because they had this thing where a whole bunch of people were in there, and they had some sentence hanging over their head that if they screwed up the school thing, and they didn't even have piss tests or anything, it was just if you didn't show up, you know, and you missed the class and got kicked out, then you'd go back to court and get whatever your sentence is. And so it wasn't very hard to live up to what the requirement was if you wanted to keep your ass out of jail or whatever the case may be. But there were 40 of us that started that class, and after that year went by, there were about 7 of us left. And that's what alcohol and drugs did to those people. It took them all back to the same old bullshit, and they didn't get a chance to get it together. You know, I imagine some of you are in here because you're, you know, sent by the courts, as they say, and all that. But they made it very clear to me that what they were doing was saying, you know, we got these jails filled up with people, and they're here just because of drugs and alcohol, mainly, and their crimes even come out of that. He said, we're not doing you any good by just keep locking you up, so we're going to give you a chance to learn from these people and know how to stay sober. So if you go out there and you get it together and do it right, God bless you. You're on your way. And if not, you'll be back and we'll give you whatever sentence is waiting for you. And they made that real clear to me, that I wasn't getting sentenced to AA. They were giving me a chance to go there, find out what the hell was going on in my life, and have me give me a chance to change. And I'm really grateful for that, and I'm really grateful for the way they handled that and the way they explained that to me. But like I said, it was exciting going to those meetings, and it was fun, and every meeting was like some big, you know, double dare you to get up there and be more honest than you were last meeting and all that kind of stuff. And we were up there confessing to everybody, and it was just so much fun. I had a great experience of going through some weird relationship thing where I definitely wasn't ready for, but by the time that thing was over with, I was a blubbering maniac. I couldn't get up on this podium without crying and whining about who I was and snot coming out of my nose and all that stuff. And boy, I'll tell you, I don't know if the rest of you are like this, but that's the kind of thing that would be the most horrible thing I could imagine ever happening to me, was stand up in front of a group of people and go through that kind of being that out of control of my emotions and unable to put on a front and all that. But it happened, and the weirdest thing was, no one said, ha ha, cry baby, you know, no one pulled that shit. You know, I got off the podium and another cry baby got up there, you know. And I just went on, and I was just another member of AA, and it was just, like I said, that would have been one of the things I thought I couldn't even live through, and that happened, and it was nothing. And that's the way AA's been all along. All the stuff they ask us to do that sound impossible, they end up being just a big relief, and one more way to liberate us from our own prison that we built for ourselves, you know. At least that's how I see it. But anyway, you know, after a couple of years went by and I was having fun being a part of AA and I was working these steps and I was making amends and I met this other sponsor that got me working in the service stuff, setting up chairs like for a meeting like this and things like that. I was driving along one day and it just dawned on me that I'd been sober for like 2 years. And I could see that prayer that I made that morning got answered right away, and I hadn't even known, you know, that God had changed the one thing in me that had to change. And that was this attitude I had. It changed me from a back row wise guy to a front row student, and I became teachable for the first time in my life. And, you know, when I met Jack, it was after my first sponsor got me through, you know, probably up to the amends steps around there. And Jack was the guy that, kind of like Bill here, he sets up these meetings and stuff, and he enjoys booking speakers from out of town. And he had all these great speakers coming every Saturday night. And he talked me into coming to help and be on his steering committee, which meant I set up chairs and made coffee and stuff. And we started doing that, and after a little while with him, you know, we'd ride around the car and talk, and I realized that he seemed like I wanted to get one of these badass sponsors that wouldn't take no shit and would tell me exactly what to do. And he acted like he was one of those guys, but he never really became that, you know. He talked to me, he accepted me exactly like I was. He encouraged me to be what I could be. And I don't think he ever belittled me, ever, in the whole time we knew each other. And I remember one day we're riding along in his car, and I was telling him what a bad sponsor he was and how he was doing something all wrong or something like that. And he says, well, this is okay. You want to go get a different sponsor? Go ahead. And by that time, I'd been hanging out with him and depending on him for a year or two or something. And it just, reality check, man, scared the shit out of me to think, how am I going to go through life without this guy helping me out? Who am I going to go to when things seem crazy and I don't know what to do about it? So he was a really, really big part of getting me sober and putting me on a path that has worked for me. It's not the same path other sponsors put out for people. You know, you get someone that stayed sober and they're still staying sober and they're your sponsor, they're going to show you how they did it. And it's probably going to work for you. As long as it ain't your way, it's probably going to work. But he told me... he told me this thing about service. He was real big in this service thing about getting plugged into a meeting like this and saying, I'm going to be the chair guy, or I'm going to be the person that gets the speakers, or I'm going to be the treasurer. But the main thing is I'm committed and I'm going to be here every week. And I'm going to be here and I'm going to do my part. And I didn't know all the self-esteem crap that was going to come out of these things, all this stuff about learning that, hey, you know, I really can take on responsibility, and hey, I really can do a good job of taking care of business when I say I'm going to do it. All those things I learned from doing that. But he just pushed me there, and he said, that's the thing. He said, don't let go of AA, you know. Stay plugged into AA and however you're doing. If you're big on the organized service like H&I and secretary meetings and making coffee and doing that kind of stuff, then do that and throw yourself into that. And if you're really big into leading a bunch of new people around and being a sponsor to a lot of people, then do that. You know, the thing is, as long as you're putting your effort into being an AA member, whether, you know, there's all these different ideas of what's going to be a good AA member and what's going to be a bad AA member, but the important thing is that you are an AA member, and you show up and you be who the hell you really are, and then the new guy can hear the guy with the same kind of goofy-ass problems he has someone that knows how to stay sober through all that, you know? That thing I talked about a little earlier about the emotional sensitivity, the grandiosity, and the childishness, I haven't been able to kick all that stuff. My immediate response to any kind of criticism is to go on the defense. I don't automatically say, what can I learn from this? I say, screw you. What were you doing? You know? And that's my immediate thought process. Well, what I discovered when we were talking about this in the meeting the other morning was, AA taught me how to see that. AA has taught me how to recognize in myself. It's enabled me to, instead of busting up and screwing up all the relationships I'm in because of it and making it a way of life, it's allowed me to spot check myself, correct when I'm wrong, and get on with being a decent human being, you know, and not tying myself up with all this mental illness all the time, you know. Reaching out to this higher power and asking for help. My last little pitch on this higher power thing, find the one that works for you I know that I know from my own experience that if you reach out to this power, that power enters your life. I mean, and however that happens for you, I think it doesn't matter what I think. It happens. That's all I'm saying. There's been some times, especially early on in this whole pandemic thing, where I was really worried about God, hugging all these people scared the shit out of me tonight. I don't know what's... I've been laying low. But anyway, but there were times when all this mortality stuff and all this... It all sounded a lot scarier at the beginning, I guess. But I got down on my knees and was praying in a different way than I had in a long time. You know, my eight prayers have gotten real automatic. They're just like the third-step prayer, seven-step prayer, the Lord's Prayer, St. Francis Prayer. You know, and I just say those over and over again and hope they kind of come into my life and be... And I say thank you a lot because God's given me a good life. But there I was feeling scared again about something. And I hadn't felt that kind of just fear, like I'm powerless over taking care of my fear. And I just got down and started talking to God about it and stuff. And what I realized that night or that morning when I was doing that is, you know, I get up from that prayer and immediately the fear and the nerve, you know. And it wasn't so much that there's some answer to some problem was happened, but that reaching out to this power and reaffirming that idea that the power's up there, not here, you know, gave me peace. And I find that that's what I get when I go see God. When I go talk to God, I get peace. And it's there anytime I want it. That's the amazing thing. I don't know why I don't just walk around praying all the time. Because I guess we got to do other stuff. But it's just amazing how there's these lessons that we get to learn in AA over and over and over again, and they're all so simple and basic, you know, that we're not bad people, we're just sick people. And we're not trying to get good, we're trying to get well. And there's this loving God up there that'll take care of us if we just reach out and ask God for help and ask Him to show us how we can maybe help another guy. And how simple is that, you know? But anyway, God, I've already talked this hour, and it's been nice being here. Thank you all for listening.